15. The Edge of the Sea. There were now more than 20 men and women inside Rama, 6 of them down on the plane, the rest ferrying equipment and expendables through the airlock system and down the stairway. The ship itself was almost deserted, with the minimum possible staff on duty. The joke went around that Endeavour was really being run by the 4 simps, and that Goldie had been given the rank of acting commander. For these first explorations, Norton had established a number of ground rules. The most important dated back to the earliest days of man's spacefaring. Every group, he had decided, must contain one person with prior experience, but not more than one. In that way, everybody would have an opportunity to learn as quickly as possible. And so, the first party to head for the Cylindrical Sea, though it was led by Surgeon Commander Laura Ernst, had as its one-time veteran Boris Rodrigo, just back from Paris. The third member, Sergeant Peter Rousseau, had been with the backup teams at the hub. He was an expert on space reconnaissance instrumentation, but on this trip he would have to depend on his own eyes and a small portable telescope. From the foot of Stairway Alpha to the edge of the sea was just under 15 kilometers, or an Earth equivalent of 8 under the low gravity of Rama. Laura Ernst, who had to prove that she lived up to her own standards, set a brisk pace. They stopped for 30 minutes at the midway mark and made the whole trip in a completely uneventful 3 hours. It was also quite monotonous, walking forward in the beam of the searchlight through the anechoic darkness of Rama. As the pool of light advanced with them, it slowly elongated into a long, narrow ellipse. This foreshortening of the beam was the only visible sign of progress. If the observers up on the hub had not given them continual distance checks, they could not have guessed whether they had traveled 1 kilometer or 5. Or 10. They just plodded onward through the million-year-old night, over an apparently seamless metal surface. But at last, far ahead, at the limits of the now weakening beam, there was something new. On a normal world, it would have been a horizon. As they approached, they could see that the plane on which they were walking came to an abrupt stop. They were nearing the edge of the sea. "Only 100 meters, said Hub Control. "Better slow down." That was hardly necessary, yet they had already done so. From the level of the plain to that of the sea, if it was a sea and not another sheet of that mysterious crystalline material, was a sheer straight drop of 50 meters. Although Norton had impressed upon everyone the danger of taking anything for granted in Rama, few doubted that the sea was really made of ice. But for what conceivable reason was the cliff on the southern shore 500 meters high, instead of the 50 here? It was as if they were approaching the edge of the world. Their oval of light, cut off abruptly ahead of them, became shorter and shorter. But far out on the curved screen of the sea, their monstrous foreshortened shadows had appeared, magnifying and exaggerating every movement. Those shadows had been their companions every step of the way as they marched down the beam, but now that they were broken at the edge of the cliff, they no longer seemed part of them. They might have been creatures of the cylindrical sea, waiting to deal with any intruders into their domain. Because they were now standing on the edge of a 50-meter cliff, it was possible for the first time to appreciate the curvature of Rama. But no one had ever seen a frozen lake bent upward into a cylindrical surface. That was distinctly unsettling, and the eye did its best to find some other interpretation. It seemed to Dr. Ernst, who had once made a study of visual illusions, that half the time she was really looking at a horizontally curving bay, not a surface that soared up into the sky. It required a deliberate effort of will to accept the fantastic truth. Only in the line directly ahead, parallel to the axis of Rama, was normality preserved. In this direction alone was there agreement between vision and logic. Here, for the next few kilometers at least, Rama looked flat, and was flat. And out there, beyond their distorted shadows and the outer limit of the beam, lay the island that dominated the cylindrical sea. "Hub control," Dr. Ernst radioed. "Please aim your beam at New York." The night of Rama fell suddenly upon them as the oval of light went sliding out to sea. Conscious of the now invisible cliff at their feet, they all stepped back a few meters. Then, as if by some magical stage transformation, the towers of New York sprang into view. The resemblance to old-time Manhattan was only superficial. This star-born echo of Earth's past possessed its own unique identity. The more Dr. Ernst stared at it, the more certain she became that it was not a city at all. The real New York, like all of man's habitations, had never been finished. Still less had it been designed. This place, however, had an overall symmetry and pattern, though one so complex that it eluded the mind. It had been conceived and planned by some controlling intelligence, and then it had been completed like a machine devised for some specific purpose. After that, there was no possibility of growth or change. The beam of the searchlight slowly tracked along those distant towers and domes and interlocked spheres and crisscrossed tubes. Sometimes there was a brilliant reflection as some flat surface shot the light back toward them. The first time this happened, they were all taken by surprise. It was exactly as if, over there on that strange island, someone was signaling to them. But there was nothing that they could see here that was not already shown in greater detail on photographs taken from the hub. After a few minutes, they called for the light to return to them and began to walk eastward along the edge of the cliff. It had been plausibly theorized that somewhere there must surely be a flight of steps or a ramp leading down to the sea. And one crewman, who was a keen sailor, had raised an interesting conjecture. "Where there's a sea," Sergeant Ruby Barnes had predicted, "there must be docks and harbors and ships. You can learn everything about a culture by studying the way it builds boats." Her colleagues thought this a rather restricted point of view, but at least it was a stimulating one. Dr. Ernst had almost given up the search and was preparing to make a descent by rope when Rodrigo spotted the narrow stairway. It could easily have been overlooked in the shadowed darkness below the edge of the cliff, for there was no guardrail or other indication of its presence, and it seemed to lead nowhere. It ran down the 50-meter vertical wall at a steep angle and disappeared below the surface of the sea. They scanned the flight of steps with their helmet lights, could see no conceivable hazard, and Dr. Ernst got Commander Norton's permission to descend. A minute later, she was cautiously testing the surface of the sea. Her foot slithered almost frictionlessly back and forth. The material felt exactly like ice. It was ice. When she struck it with her hammer, a familiar pattern of cracks radiated from the impact point, and she had no difficulty in collecting as many pieces as she wished. Some had already melted when she held up the sample holder to the light. The liquid appeared to be slightly turbid water, and she took a cautious sniff. "Is that safe?" Rodrigo called down, with a trace of anxiety. "Believe me, Boris," she answered, "if there are any pathogens around here that have slipped through my detectors, our insurance policies lapsed a week ago." But Rodrigo had a point. Despite all the tests that had been carried out, there was a slight risk that this substance might be poisonous, or might carry some unknown disease. In normal circumstances, Dr. Ernst would not have taken even this minuscule chance. Now, however, time was short, and the stakes were enormous. If it became necessary to quarantine Endeavor, that would be a small price to pay for her cargo of knowledge. "It's water, but I wouldn't care to drink it. It smells like an algae culture that's gone bad. I can hardly wait to get it to the lab."
"Is the ice safe to walk on?"
"Yes, solid as a rock."
"Then we can get to New York."
"Can we, Peter? Have you ever tried to walk across 4 kilometers of ice?"
"Oh, I see what you mean. Just imagine what stores would say if we asked for a set of skates. Not that many of us would know how to use them, even if we had any aboard."
"And there's another problem," put in Rodrigo. "Do you realize that the temperature is already above freezing? Before long, that ice is going to melt. How many spacemen can swim 4 kilometers? Certainly not this one."
Dr. Ernst rejoined them at the edge of the cliff and held up the small sample bottle in triumph.
"It's a long walk for a few cc's of dirty water, but it may teach us more about Rama than anything we've found so far. Let's head for home."
They turned toward the distant lights of the hub, moving with the gentle, loping strides that had proved the most comfortable means of walking under this reduced gravity. Often they looked back, drawn by the hidden enigma of the island out there in the center of the frozen sea. And just once, Dr. Ernst thought she felt the faint suspicion of a breeze against her cheek. It did not come again, and she quickly forgot about it.